Morning and evening, maids heard the goblins cry, come buy our orchard fruits, come buy, come buy. Apples and quinces, lemons and oranges, plump unpecked cherries, melons and raspberries, bloom-down-cheeked peaches, swart-headed mulberries, wild free-born cranberries, crab apples, dewberries, pineapples, blackberries, apricots, strawberries, all ripe together in summer weather, morns that pass by, fair eves that fly, come by, come by. Our grapes fresh from the vine, pomegranates full and fine, dates and sharp bullesses, that's one I don't know, rare pears and greengages, I don't know greengages either, damsons and bilberries, taste them and try, currants and gooseberries, bright fire-like barberries, figs to fill your mouth, citrons from the south, sweet to tongue and sound to eye, come by, come by. So opens the first stanza of Christina Rossetti's Goblin Market.
What a perfect poem for spring. The promise of spring and summer, right?
Yeah.
No blights, no droughts, no labor strikes, just the market's full of luscious fruits.
Well, it's supposed to be a fantastic representation of goblins having these... I mean, you're supposed to be sucked in because it's unrealistic, right? I mean, none of those fruits would be in season at the same time. So, like, your best versions of all those fruits. It's just not realistic.
Christina's going to hate you, Jonah.
Well, but it's not supposed to be realistic. So.
Okay, so we're hoping at least one of our listeners will know. That would be Goblin Market by Christina Rossetti.
Yeah.
Probably the greatest long poem in the English language, other than Lady of Shalott by Tennyson. What is it about those 19th century poets, man?
Well, I don't know. I've always had a soft spot for Wordsworth, too.
Yeah, me too.
But, yeah, I don't know. It's that mix of strict classicism with a new regard for the freeness of where poetry could be taken. Right. Sure. I mean, like, in Christina Rossetti's biography... It's like she basically lived a life like Emily Dickinson, more or less.
Right.
I mean, she was a kind of a solitary lady that lived in her own room and sort of wrote quasi-religious.
So she was not married then?
No. Yeah, that's what
her brother was Dante Gabriel Rossetti, and they had a brother-sister. They were very close, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
But I might be wrong.
Well, we're just going to say that's what happened and then speculate on
what
that
means.
Well,
it just kind of seems that way. Anyway, we're going to have groaning in the listenership, but I'm pretty sure. But that adds an extra, an extra analytical level to the poem itself, right? Because as you brought out, Jonah brought out to me some hidden eroticism.
It's not very hidden, really. It's pretty right on the nose.
But it's been between two girls, right?
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder if she doesn't hide it by making it a girl, when it could very well be her brother, right?
I mean, it does seem, yeah, like, no, that's true. I mean, they both, like, what I first suggested to you was it sounded like maybe there was some kind of hidden lesbian allegory or whatever,
right?
But yeah, it could be a brother sister hidden by another girl who's a good friend, and
right.
Yeah. So you. Well, I mean, that section goes. The one girl, I forget her name. She goes to the goblin market. She eats the fruit. She completely indulges in it while her. I don't know, her friend.
Who's the writer of the poem?
Well, I don't know. I think it's just her name. Lizzie is the one who's trying to help her.
Right.
Oh. No, Laura is the one that tried to help her. Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. Laura and Lizzie. Anyway.
Okay.
So Laura tastes the goblin's fruit, and then she can't do anything anymore.
All she wants to do is taste that fruit. Yeah. And eat that goblin fruit.
Yeah. Like everything else tastes bad in comparison. So Lizzie goes down to the goblin market, and she just refuses to taste the fruit. She just wants to bring it back for her sister. And then the goblins get really upset, and they like start smearing fruit on her face, like trying to make her eat it, but she doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So then the fruit juices drip down her, and she runs back home, and it says, clutched her hair. Lizzie, Lizzie, have you tasted for my sake the fruit forbidden? Must your light like mine be hidden? Your young life like mine be wasted? Undone in mine undoing, and ruined in my ruin. Thirsty, cankered, goblin-ridden, she clung about her sister, kissed and kissed and kissed her. Tears once again refreshed her sunken eyes, dropping like rain after long sultry drouth. Shaking with anguish, fear, and pain, she kissed and kissed her with a hungry mouth. And then, like,
she says to her sister.
Her lips began to scorch. That juice was wormwood to her tongue. She loathed the feast. Writhing as one possessed, she leaped and sung, rent all her robe and wrung her hands in lamentable haste, and beat her breast, her locks streamed like the torch, borne by a racer at full speed, or like the mane of horses in their flight, or like an eagle when she stems the light straight toward the sun, or like a cage thing freed, or like a flying flag when armies run.
It's the greatest poem ever, man. God, it's so good, I can't believe it.
I mean, that's one of the beautiful, but almost kind of, about, like, here's seven ways to describe the same thing.
Of course.
And none of them are particularly
good. Of course. But it's so glorious, because, you know, just reading it in little snatches, like you're reading, it's like the forbidden fruit, right. But here's this cloistered woman, right? And the goblin is going to free her into the sensuous world, right? And into this world of freedom. And so, I mean, the hyperbole of the, you know, of the eagle at the stem of light, I mean, it's okay, man, because, you know, anyway, spectacular poem, man.
Yeah. I guess it's just having fun with the language. Maybe I try too hard to try and deduce what it's actually saying. Maybe it was just a fun idea that she liked. Maybe whatever is represented in her, in what we see in the allegory, is completely from the unconscious part of her brain.
That I was just gonna say that. Absolutely, I think she dreamed this, and it was like so glorious. And
that would make sense.
And I mean, she wakes up, it just in a fever and a sweat with the glory of this dream, you know. And of course, she does live a solitary life, so there's no husband or whatever to, you know, say, hey, we're going to dinner tonight or something. I mean, she's in a dream world. And in a smart ache, tingle, Lizzie went her way, knew not was it night or day, sprang up the bank, tore through the firs, threaded copse and dingle, and heard her penny jingle, bouncing in her purse. Its bounce was music to her ear. She ran and ran, as if she feared some goblin man dogged her with gibe or curse, or something worse. But not one goblin scurried after, nor was she pricked by fear. The kind heart made her windy paced, and urged her home quite out of breath with haste and inward laughter. She cried, Lara, up the garden, did you miss me? Come and kiss me. Never mind my bruises. Hug me, kiss me. Suck my juices. Squeeze from goblin fruits for you, goblin pulp and goblin dew. Eat me, drink me, love me. Lara, make much of me. For your sake, I have braved the glen, and had to do with goblin merchant men. So great. So great. Yeah. Of course. Yeah, she. That was earlier than what you wrote, and but I obviously.
Well, it was a little. It was right before that. Right. The kissing section, but.
Right, life out of death. That night long, Lizzie watched by her, countered her pulses flagging, stir, felt for her breath, held water to her lips and cooled her face with tears and fanning leaves. But when the first birds chirped about their eaves, and early reapers plodded to the place of golden sheaves and dew-wet grass, bowed in the morning winds so brisk to pass, and new buds with new day opened of cup-like lilies on the stream, Laura woke as from a dream, laughed in the innocent old way, hugged Lizzie, but not twice or thrice. Her gleaming locks showed not one thread of gray. Her breath was sweet as May, and light danced in her eyes. Just so spectacular, so spectacular.
Breath sweet as May.
Right? And here we are. And here we are, yes.
I suppose it depends on what part of the country you're in, if May is sweet. Or I guess May is sweet for everybody who's in the north, northern country.
Have done with sorrow. I'll bring you plums tomorrow, fresh on their mother's twigs. Cherries worth getting. You cannot think what figs my teeth have met in, what melons icy cold, piled on a dish of gold, too huge for me to hold, what peaches with a velvet nap, pellucid grapes without one seed. Odorous indeed must be the mead whereon they grow, and pure the wave they drink, with lilies at the brink, and sugar sweet their sap. I mean, this is the most sensuous, wonderful poem ever, man. Oh my gosh.
You do like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can open up anywhere. But anyway, yeah. Goblin Market by Christina Rossetti. And lived her life in the cloister.
Yeah, or the...
Turned her back on the Goblin Market. The pain and the gall of human love.
Well, I mean, the rest of that book is filled with just really, really, I don't know, kind of over-the-top religious poems.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't know what I mean by over-the-top, just that, yeah, I mean, like she was in a cloister, like she fell in love with God in that mm-hmm. way, in that mm-hmm. old school way.
Mm-hmm. In that old school way.
Which, for anybody who's so read Nietzsche, is impossible, because it's like falling in love with somebody who doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's great. May. I cannot tell you how it was, but this I know. It came to pass upon a bright and breezy day, when May was young, ah, pleasant May, and yet the poppies were not born between the blades of tender corn. The last eggs had not hatched as yet, nor any bird forgot its mate. I cannot tell you what it was, but this I know, it did but pass. It passed away with sunny May, with all sweet things it passed away, and left me old and cold and gray. Man, that's like Hemingway, man.
Did Hemingway write poetry?
Yeah.
He must have at some point. Pretty much every writer does at some point.
Right. Well, we get to the, you know, the idea of the diamond and the lotus. You know, I mean, Goblin Market is the lotus, and Christine wants that diamond. You know, she does not want to die. She does not want to die.
So, indulging in things is a reaction against death. Is what you're suggesting?
Well, you know, like, for instance, what's the disease where a young girl just doesn't want to eat anymore?
Oh, anorexia?
Anorexia, yeah. They want to stay like 11 years old.
Is that what that is? They want to stay 11 years old? What?
Yeah,
what do you
yeah.
mean by that?
I mean, well, I mean, if you stop eating, you... In a woman, I mean, everything just kind of stops, you know.
Reduction.
Yeah. And, you know, and I mean, that's the big thing about, you know, all these gay designers, right? They want these 12-year-old models, right? They don't want a woman who has got full breasts and full hips and, you know, ripe for birthing and ripe for, you know, giving children and everything.
I always thought that had something to do with the fact that that model type just suited hanging clothes on better. Like, you don't see hippie, what I mean is hip, like womanly hips on mannequins, really. I mean, they're usually pretty slender hip, right?
Sure, yeah.
So, I don't know.
Well, that's why, that's why, this is a good partnership, man. I mean, you're always bringing, yeah, basically these gays are just mercantile and, well, yeah, it just makes a hell of a lot easier and saves on cloth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I sort of like the idea that, I like the idea that anorexia is a returning to a kind of adolescence, because in my mind that...
Pre-adolescence.
Yeah, because that speaks to a being owned. You know, it's like, it's not that their body, that it's a reaction against their body, it's a reaction to their freedom or something. Like, it's
you're
like,
right, they are refusing. There's a refusal there, yeah.
Like, I want my body to be meaningful, and this is one of the ways that I can control that meaning. Like,
or I want my body to be meaningless.
Yeah, I guess.
In terms of normal human development, you're going, no, fuck it, I'm not going to, I mean...
But if your body's meaningless, then just get fat or whatever. You know, like, you wouldn't have a complex about it, right? You just wouldn't care.
I hate that about you, Joe, and you're always coming up with these alternate ideas. Totally train wrecking my, you know, throwing the switch on my great train going down the road.
I'm just riffing. I'm riffing on your original idea. That's all I'm doing.
I know, man. I love it. No, I love it. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing of, but I mean, you know, again, getting back to Freud, we might talk about this before. I mean, Freud was wrong about most of his things, but he was really right about, you know, the idea of development. And if you have trauma or anxiety at any stage of development, you stop there, whether you're male or female. And, but no, I really love that idea of the body it's a brilliant idea you just came up with, man. It's so much better than mine. Yeah, the person says, wait, I will make my body not available to this certain symbolization, right? Or this use or this purpose, which Mother Nature is foisting upon these poor girls. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the whole history of femininity is the mortal danger of pregnancy. You know, I mean, what the heck? Until the last 50 years, you know, or 60 years. So, a lot of it is the refusal. Of course, I do, I have, you know, in my vast experience in the store, I meet a lot of different people, and you see young men who, in their 20s and 30s, have, by a similar form of anorexia, have basically refused to, you know,
become part,
take their knocks like you and I have, you know, in the world. And, see, I've seen it in both young men and young women, and it's also rather not terrifying, but it's kind of sad, right? And I mean, that again, that's why I'm glad that we're talking about Goblin Market, because these issues are all in there, you know. They're all there.
Yeah, there's something of them in there. So do you think you're suggesting that oh my gosh, I started going down a track and then I thought about something else.
What were we talking about?
You got cover for me. I'm getting older.
This always happens to me.
I'm getting older.
No, it's being around me, Jonah. This is the first time it's happened. So, yeah. So reconstructing the situation, we were talking about, okay, both young men and women will refuse the passage, right? The idea of the body.
No, it's something about taking Knox that I was thinking about.
Oh, right, okay. Right.
Oh, okay, this is what it was. Was, do you think for a woman, getting pregnant is tantamount to taking your Knox?
Amen.
Like, that's the feminine version of taking your Knox.
Exactly, exactly so. Yeah, that you accept the fact that you're going to die and, you know, you're going to suffer and
well, it's also like, you know, you're going to lose a little bit of yourself when you get pregnant, right? I mean, like, it's like, as Stacy loves to say, a child is basically a parasite. And she's not wrong. I mean, like, something happens to women.
Oh, gosh. Right? No, I mean, the ailments that visit women who undergo long pregnancies are like, COVID-19 are long term, you know. I mean, it's so stressful upon them, right? There are some women, you know, my ex-wife, I mean, man, she bloomed. She bloomed when she got pregnant, you know. And also it gave her a lot of power. I mean, she saw it in that form.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think that's another.
But I mean, that's one of the things about that taking your Knox is what you learn about taking your Knox is, like, you learn you can live and handle it. And that actually gives you a weird sense of power. You know, that's why I think why I try and tell people to read literature, or the analogy I was thinking about the other day was Richard Feynman. Like, Richard Feynman, when, like, I think he's trying to tell his students, like, learning a little bit about physics actually gives you superpowers, right? Because he used to have this thing where he would, like, hold a bowling ball in front of his face, and then he'd let it go, and it would swing, and then it'd swing right back up, and he just didn't move. And, like, your brain, everything in your brain tells you that you should move. There's something flying right at your face. But because he knows inertia is a real thing, he knows he can just stand there. So, in a sense, knowing something gives you the superpower mm-hmm. to overcome your basic reaction to things.
Well, sure. Sure. And you can only... you can only do that by experience, too, usually. I mean, granted, he had the theoretical, but he probably tried it.
But that was a pretty strong theory. I mean, inertia is, like, a pretty established theory.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, yeah, in some part of the universe, maybe that bowling ball catches a little...
isn't that interesting? Burst. Yeah, we were talking about that, how empirical knowledge, once it becomes, you know, accepted... Yeah, it becomes almost empirical. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah.
Definitely gravity is, right? But gravity is always an experience.
Yeah, but gravity is pretty obvious to almost everybody. Right. Like, everybody knows if you trip, you're going to fall. You know, I mean, I don't think you can overcome that with any intellectualism
mm-hmm.
of any kind.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, this thing with the bowling ball... Yes, thank you. He's holding it from his teeth?
Yeah, he just held it right up to his face.
Right.
And then he just let it go. Yeah, I mean, he just made sure it wasn't touching his nose.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta, like, if you pressed it into your face and then you let it swing on the string, yeah, it might come and hit you a little. But I mean, you just gotta set it right in front of your face. Because you know it's not gonna catch any energy.
God, I'm still having a hard time visualizing this.
Really? Oh, yeah. This is so, this
yeah, Chris, I've always had trouble with three-dimensional models.
So, okay.
Okay.
I stand up. There's a string connecting
the from the ceiling.
Yeah, from the ceiling.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've got that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And you set it. You set it at the apex of one, and you stand there, and you let it swing back, and it's not going to swing any further.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's kind of the symmetry, a law of symmetry, too, I'm sure.
Well, yeah. Well, right. I mean, if in this sense, it's built on what would you call it? I guess an axis, so, yeah. I don't know.
Well, it's going to swing symmetrically. That's Yeah, and that's the essence of music. Boom, boom, so great. You know, I just think our listeners are, I'm sure they're just really having a great time as Will wanders through the wonders of physics. Yes,
Well, you
yes,
know,
yes.
if they're not having a good
Yeah,
time,
yeah.
they really don't have to listen. And that's about as far as my interest or care can possibly go into
Right,
these things anymore.
right,
Like,
right. But we got Feynman. We've gone from Rossetti to Feynman. Who else are we going to work into this broadcast?
well, I've got another one,
Really? Who's
but I
that?
don't know if you're going to enjoy it.
Who's that?
Well, it's the book I tried to get you to read.
Oh, yes. That's right. That's right. And this involves an amphibious jeep
Yeah.
that was built in order to invade Southeast Asia
Yeah.
and against emplaced machine guns. So it was armor. It had a certain amount of armor. But yes, I can't believe it. This jeep was built, and this seaman, this Australian seaman, bought one and decided he was going to traverse the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And it's only, what, like 20 feet long, something like that?
Yeah.
I didn't believe it. When Jonah told me about this, I really didn't believe it until I saw it, a picture of it on the ocean.
Yeah, it's well, I really thought yeah, you could get through it, which sort of in a weird way made me feel good because I was like, "Oh, 'cause this book was one of my secrets, or it's been one of my secrets for the last 7 years. When I discovered it up in Alaska, when I was reading it, the screenplay was just writing itself. I was like, this is an amazing story about something that's never been touched before, and it's got two perfect characters. And I mean, like, yeah. Anyway, it's something I've always thought would be a
Okay, the two
fantastic thing to
perfect
do.
characters are,
Well,
well, the hero.
they're balanced, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if so it's about a young journalist and translator who's living in Japan. And the title of the book is called Once a Fool. And it's about him doing this stupid thing, which that's another thing that I love about the book. He's got this great moral at the end where he's like, you guys don't do this. This was stupid. And that's what I was thinking about at that time in my life was, man, there's a lot of travel stuff that you can do that just doesn't get you anything. You don't learn anything. You just went out and did something stupid for no reason, you know? And I loved that moral that is like, no, there is no moral. This was just dumb. That's my favorite moral of an ending of a story.
That's true, and I think that's why I didn't read it, because I could see it's like, wait a second, I can see the guy. I mean, it starts slow, and he's a journalist. He's not an artist, right?
Yeah, no, he's not an
And
artist, no.
so he's perfect for this story. Sketch out the lead character.
Well, our lead character, who I doubt there's anyone who's listening to this who's gonna who will make this connection, but I swear to God, if Jared Harris, the British guy from Mad Men, played him as an Australian, a crazy Australian, he would win an Oscar. So he's
You're right, because of his temper tantrum.
yeah he's yeah he's
Because
got these weird temper tantrums,
in a way, it's kind of like Macbeth or Lear. This guy is totally nuts.
but he's also a genius.
Right.
Like, who else but a genius could get a jeep, an amphibious jeep, mechanically across the Pacific Ocean? Like, you literally have to be a genius of a kind,
Yeah, right.
you know. And at the end, boy, Dementi, he says, you know. He later realized that Carlin spent this guy's name is Carlin. I forget his first name. I wanted to say George, but obviously he's the comedian. Carlin, he just gets completely attached to this Jeep. He becomes a slave to the idea of him being good at this. And it's got all these really interesting thematic components to it. But like about how he's. he's completely fixated on the fact that this Jeep is going to give him the boon that he needs. He's like, he's attached to it. There's a scene where they land in Anchorage, and so they make it across the Pacific Ocean, spoiler alert. But the climax of the film, in my mind, is just them sitting in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and they realize their alternator is broken, and there's no way they can charge the battery, and they've got, like, one turn on the key, and they got to make sure the generator's fixed. And it's just, like, one of these anticlimactic moments, you know, there's the Jeep just bobbing, and it's, like, wet. It's wet. Like, when it's cold in the middle of the ocean, they have to close the hood of the Jeep, but when they close the hood of the Jeep, everything starts to, like, moisturize and get wet. So, like, they're literally sleeping in sleeping bags that are soaked. And, like, there's just all kinds of little details like this that are, I mean.
And they're crossing in the summer.
Well, you have to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's like the springish.
So how do they carry enough fuel to do this?
So he attaches a rope with a spare fuel tank that's shaped like a torpedo, and it's constantly threatening to puncture the Jeep. So, like, every few hours they'll have to go out and, like, make sure it's not coming towards them, or, like, some stray wave has sent this fuel container. I mean, it's just it's bizarre, and it's got all the it moves just with the beat of a movie too. It's got this moment where they start running into all these Japanese fishing lines, and so it snags the propeller in the back, and they've got to, like, get down and unclog the propeller the second time it happens. So this guy Carlin, who is this completely enigmatic and crazy Australian mechanic, he strips off all his clothes and dives into the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Northern Pacific.
Yeah, Northern Pacific Ocean. Yeah, they're heading towards Alaska. Yeah. Cutting strips of the fishing net out
as
of
he's holding his breath.
Propeller shaft. Yeah. As he's holding it. It's insane. And then this Japanese fishing boat comes by, and they see what they're trying to do, and they try and help him. So a Japanese guy comes onto their Jeep, and he accidentally spills one of Carlin's cameras into the ocean. And Carlin is so worked up over losing that $450 camera or whatever that he just starts this horrible screaming tirade. So it's like he's never quite a hero. Like, in some sense, you can see, like, Thor or whatever doing something heroic. Like, oh, yeah, I can swim through the Pacific Ocean, no problem. But he does that. But it's also counterbalanced with him being an insane person.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of what I love about his character, is it's so real. It's
Yeah, you've got me sold on it. See, but I mean, it is a little bit like Macbeth or Lear, in a way. Because he is mad.
Yeah.
But I also love your idea of the boon. It's like, I have found a way to make my life worth meaning. I mean, I've been a mechanic. I've suffered through World War II.
Yeah.
You know, and all these flyboys and all these officers and everything. You know, and I've been keeping this thing going. And this is going to be my payoff, right?
Yeah.
And on top of that, the irony, he finds this kind of pudgy little French guy to go with him, right? Yeah.
Well, that's what's so interesting about the book to me, was it wasn't told through Carlin's perspective. He's a journalist in the best sense. He's hard on Carlin when he should be hard on him, you know, but at the same time, he gives him credit when he deserves credit. I don't know. You stopped reading after that opening scene, which I thought is such a perfect character moment, which is that he goes out and gets really drunk. They're in Japan before they're about to take off, so they realize, you know, they might go out and die. I mean, more or less. I mean, even though the French guy doesn't seem very concerned, because he's not thinking about it. He's being stupid. Same way I would have done when I was 26. You know? But he does that thing where he comes in with a Japanese girl and he pushes her onto the French guy. And he's like, hey, have at it. You know, I just had to go at her, and he shows her, he splits his robe, and he's got the red knees from screwing her on the hard mats of a Japanese hotel. But at the same time, it's totally deranged, and yet it's weirdly generous, you know? He's like, he's done this thing, he's like, okay, here, you know, it's like, here you go. Like, he's trying to be generous in an awful way. But
the woman's not happy about it.
Oh, yeah, she's not happy. She's not having it at all. But, I mean, she went out and, like, you know, got drunk with him at a bar and went home with him. So, obviously, she's not happy. And, like, why would she be happy? Of course she's not happy. But from his perspective, he's this insane guy who feels like he's being generous, you know, drunkenly generous. It's like, okay, you know, here... I know you didn't have the
balls. Kind of like you'd bring back a fish or something.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying he's very enlightened.
That wasn't the reason I didn't write it. It's a journalistic style.
Yeah.
Of. You know, Joan and I went out to Fort Hall, and we got, you know, we only took a 12-pack, and they didn't sell beer there. So we walked out, you know, we walked through the arcade, and we, you know, bumped shoulders with a few Braves, and we drank beer behind the arcades, and then we came out, we didn't have any beer anymore. So we drove home. You know, just kind of like that, man. That's just how the style is. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's not true. That it's not entertaining, but it's just kind of like, you know, really no Joseph Conrad here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you said to me was, I thought was very poetic. I mean, I don't know if you can remember it off the top of your head.
About what?
Well, you said, I've only got time for the sublime.
I've only got time for the sublime, man. I do, man. That's all I got time for. You know, Hemingway, everybody said it, man. I mean, it's good to start out as a journalist, but...
I mean, I could edit it out, but... Okay.
Right. So where were we?
Well, we almost always get interrupted by something.
Mm-hmm.
It should take
here we down. Are in the maw of life, trying to do art. Constantly interrupted. No sponsors. No money coming our way. Oh my God, we've been interrupted by some pretty spectacular women, though. Too bad they were intoxicated and had not read Cormac McCarthy or anything like that.
Who's this? I don't remember.
I can't remember.
Here's a fun game. Here's a fun game. Well, it'll be amusing for me. Name the books we have covered on this podcast.
Oh.
If you get half of them right, I will give you $10.
Okay. And the book we're talking about is called...
No, that doesn't count, though. This one doesn't count.
This is great. Well, if I sit down and think about it, I'll get, you know, maybe two or three of them. But I know we did a Raymond Carver, but I'm not sure which one.
Yeah, that one was kind of we just started talking about your interception theory that you were excited about.
Right. And no, I don't know which ones did we have we done.
I'm surprised that Raymond Carver was the first one that came to your mind.
Because that was my idea.
Oh.
Right. And we did do Nabokov.
Yeah, that's true.
Or which one did we do?
You don't remember?
Hmm.
So I don't know if that counts. Then.
We did Pale Fire.
Okay, there you go.
Oh, I got one.
I'll count the Raymond Carver one, too.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, that's the thing, Jonah. This podcast has a history. It's just my archival, man. Where is my production assistant? Here are the answers. So what was your favorite one?
I don't know. Honestly, if we were going to be more professional about this, we'd probably have to have just more classically better audio equipment.
And we did Possession.
That's true. That's three.
And, boy, I don't know. Gosh, but I'm working on it. So what one was your favorite one?
The one that was most interesting to me, just because it covered this weird pop culture figure who's also, he wrote books that I think are kind of underrated, weirdly. Like, I think The Naked and the Dead is pretty long and dumb, and his one about the murderer, what's his name? The Executioner song, that one's way too long too. But Prisoner of Sex by Norman Mailer, I thought was pretty interesting. Just because it covered this weird range of sort of male literature that has stuck around. I mean, people still, I mean, maybe nobody in colleges anymore are talking about D.H. Lawrence, but like as a precursor to understanding D.H. Lawrence, I think The Prisoner of Sex is kind of an interesting way of
going. Interesting. Well, you know, we're gonna have to pick a, which D.H. Lawrence are we gonna do next month?
I've never read a full one. I've never read a full D.H. Lawrence.
He just had a style that was easy to read, right? And it was
not for me, obviously.
It's kind of like, I wouldn't call it smarmy, but it does. It's got this kind of metronome rhythm, Ivana, was one of four children, and he just kind of does it. But I know I read at least two or three of them when I was a lad, 18 or 19.
All right, let's just talk about your personal life. Well,
yeah.
Let's talk about your personal life.
Perfect.
how'd you feel about your love letter that you sent? You feel pretty good about it? Do you feel like you nailed it?
Do you realize, Jonah, this is the first email I've sent in my life?
This is the very first email. Wow. That deserves like a...
And Jonah set it up for me, and I sent this great email to Tatiana in Chiapas. And you just can't believe, you probably didn't notice, I was suddenly glowing. I was like, God, damn, man. So yeah, no, that's the first one I've sent.
Well, how many love letters have you sent?
That's a really interesting point, that it's probably the first love letter I sent.
Really?
I'm kind of always been a person of the moment, and if one of the gorgeous women that I have known was right there, it kind of, the love affair lasts as long as they were there. And I might have sent a love letter more as an apology.
A comeback letter.
But how many of those are in the archives of literature? I mean, how many love letters are apologies in the end, right?
Yeah.
Baby, take me back, or you know. Yeah. So I wrote a couple of those.
I think those count. I count those.
Right. Right. But you know, we get in again, you know, I'm just getting in the 21st century, but the 20th century, later 20th century was, telephones. I mean, to sit down and compose a letter is really hard. The art of writing a good letter is really hard. I think I wrote a really good one, but you notice it was like maybe 40 words. You know, one paragraph.
More like a missive than a letter. A love missive.
Which has got its own double entendre right there, man. Yeah, it's a missive.
Well, you know, I think I think you
probably... How about a love dismissive?
A love,
right?
Oh,
I know all the genres of love letters. So, well, let me ask you, have you ever written a good love letter?
I don't know if it was good. I wrote a bunch of them to my high school.
Mm-hmm.
But that was But
oh my gosh, did you keep copies like most crass?
I got really drunk. I was home. My parents were out of town, and I just threw a big party, and I got really drunk, and people were snooping around my room, and somebody found the letters, and we read a couple of them, and I just decided, I was like, fuck it, I'm burning all these. I was like, this part of my life was over. I don't want to save anything.
God, what a cruel reception. Oh my God, can you imagine anything worse than having a bunch of drunks, 15-year-old males, on your football team, reading your letters and guffawing from the first letter, no matter what, you know? I mean, you're convicted, like, before they've even read four words,
that's,
right?
Yeah, that's true.
Right. Oh my God, that's great, man.
It was older than that. It was like after the fact. It was like I was in college and I just, you know, I was like 20 or something.
Right. Oh my God, it's a terrible age. So, I mean, it just comes back to me that's when you know you are an ambitious writer, when you keep copies of all your letters.
You're right. I'm not ambitious enough.
So I'm telling you, man, there's something so crass and tacky about all these great writers, you know,
who save everything. Or,
right. And the other thing great writers do is they always go and they find the most prominent older writer, male or female, and they knock at their door and they like carry out their garbage for 3 weeks and suck up to him for like a month.
Yeah.
You know, to get published.
Yeah.
I mean, there are all these things we haven't done, Jonah.
Yeah.
We still have our self-respect.
I might have done that. I can see myself doing that.
But you never did, though.
I never did. If I had had the opportunity, yeah.
Me too. Yeah. Me too, absolutely, man. It's never too late, though. Yeah, it's just never too late.
Well, also the whole conditions were different. I mean, I sent my first ever book to George Saunders, and he responded to me. Actually,
really?
Yeah.
You got the letter?
Well, I got a email that was like, "Hey, that was really sincere and nice, but I'm never going to read this. I have to read all my student stuff, so I'm never going to read your stuff." But I felt okay that he even responded, I guess. But I mean, it wasn't worth reading. It was terrible. It was the first thing I ever tried to write.
Really? So, really?
Yeah.
So it wasn't the Sea Slug?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That came way later.
Goddamn, send him the Sea Slug. Say, remember, Charles, when I sent you this, and I got this pro forma letter that you probably had already typed out, and you just punched a button and you didn't even write it.
Well, it wasn't long. It seemed sincere, but it wasn't long. Maybe three sentences or something.
Mm. Oh my God.
But in any case, you know, not to throw shade at George Saunders, but he has become poet laureate of shit. I mean, like, that was rather harsh. I don't mean it that way, but he's become...
It's worse to be a college professor and famous than anything, man.
Yeah, it's weird.
That's like
double,
man.
Yeah, it's Ooh. Like it's like they're so on guard for their...
You're already getting, you know, jerked off by everybody, you know,
yeah.
And now you're famous. Oh, George Saunders, sorry. Well, he'll be unhappy to know that I called him George Saunders.
Charles Saunders.
Who the hell is George Saunders?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know if you've ever read
it. He writes one great short story, man.
Yeah.
If you write one great thing, you're a great writer.
That's always given me comfort.
Take that to the bank, man. It's true, man. You write one great short story.
I thought that about when I was reading Einstein's biography. I was just thinking, you know, like how many people never really do anything, you know, significant or great. So it's like, no matter the amount of failure, if you have one good one.
Oh, absolutely.
That's enough. Like, one good idea.
No. Well, ideas are great. My new great idea is the paleological ontology of the grammatical construction of the past perfect with had. And my idea is that we being human, we will shape language to our emotional needs, right?
Sure.
There are languages that do not use the past perfect. That instead of saying, I had seen, they say, I saw. Or if you're from Idaho, they say, I seen.
I seen it.
I seen it. Right. Yeah. So they, and this is why we despise these people, because
I always liked
the past perfect is so beautiful. So have you noticed, though, had means to have.
Yes.
That's its original meaning. When a person says, I had seen
the woman. Had doesn't mean you have it. Had means you had it at one point.
That's my point. That's absolutely my point. You had possession of that vision of that woman, or had possession of, or I had realized, had possession of that realization. That's the whole emotional construct. The whole existential construct of the English language is, when I say, I had seen it, you are saying, I had possession of that vision of whatever I'm talking about, and it's actually in the construction of the past, of the past perfect. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. I had known. I had that knowledge. I had loved. I had that love. It's there, man.
Yeah.
And it's so, that's what's so glorious about it. And it's that poignance of somehow saying that I possessed something in the past and it's already gone, but I had that at one time, right?
Yeah.
I love it, man. It's the greatest idea I've ever had.
It's pretty good. I like it.
Thank you. Thank you, John. All right, man. All right.
No, I mean, you're right. I mean, I'm not, I don't, this is my big failing as a writer, is like, I don't know enough about the semantic structure of other languages to say that there isn't a way that you can represent something you had in the past and say that it's gone.
Well, it's in French as well.
Yeah, okay.
It's actually a construct that comes out of the French.
Oh, okay.
But I'm not sure about the Anglo-Saxon, but it's definitely a Germanic thing. But, man, I was just thinking about that of, you know, the whole thing of literature, you know, and the whole thing of, you know, possessing the past. This is what we do as writers, man. We're always trying to possess the past and hold on to it and create a construct. Painters are the same way, right? Or
well, it's like, it's an exercise in freedom, because once you have created that thing, you can stop thinking about it, right? Like, in a certain way.
I mean, amen. Yeah. Absolutely. No, absolutely, man.
Well, I was thinking about it recently, because I saw Tom yesterday, and he was worried about maybe he was slipping into senility a little bit.
And, it was the 8 martinis he drank when we were up there last week.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's pretty fine. But I was thinking about how much effort it takes just to remember what one is doing. Like like senility is actually weirdly, is very natural in a sense, because like just to remember what you're doing on a given basis takes an incredible amount of energy.
I think it dovetails into what I'm saying about the past perfect.
Yeah.
You are creating, exactly. Thank you, man. You create an existential effort to take possession of this, you know, and I mean, Proust does it. The thing I don't like about Proust is that instead of using the past perfect, he's always like remembering these blocks. You know, he's remembering things in set scenes.
Yeah, but that's engaging with a more classic sense of memory.
Right, exactly. So yeah.
Yeah.
And kind of scientific too.
Yeah, a little bit scientific. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good description of Proust, really, in a weird way. It's kind of it's a scientific exercise of memory.
He's reading all the philosophers, Husserl and all these guys, when he's writing this stuff. Yeah, but what's so wonderful about Proust is, man, by the sixth book, man, the sense of humor. Oh God, it's so wonderful. Yeah, but early on,
here's another thing from our podcast. I don't know how many times you have brought up Proust. And like half the time you love him and half the time you absolutely hate him.
Right.
But he always gets brought up in some way or another.
Isn't that great? Is that not greatness? Is that not establishing?
Yeah.
I had preeminence. Proust is saying, you can say a lot about me, but I had this turf down. Nobody else got it, man. Shakespeare didn't do it. Nobody did it, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Joyce didn't do it. I'm the man. I just did this. You're right. Absolutely. Bookseller in Pocatello, Idaho, man, is like a bait noir. Well, you know, the reason is because I've never read it all. I probably feel this little, like, guilt. So I'm kind of, like, compensating. Like, God, do I like him? Do I hate him? God, I haven't read the whole thing. Every time I try, it's like, oh, God, are you kidding me?
Yeah,
I can't deal with it.
It's difficult. It's very difficult.
Well, he exceeds the potential of the language. I mean, you get into these scenes where you're just kind of, you know, measuredly throwing out these mental constructs.
But they're all his mental constructs. You know, it's like it just lacks that little twinge of fun. You know, of like inviting somebody else to engage with what you're talking about.
Right.
Like I can appreciate that you're having this recollection, but that's why most books are about inviting the listener to go on a journey with you. Is like,
it's a very good point, and that's thank you for helping me clarify my thoughts about his later books. Is that in the later books, he's really witty in his kind of summary of what's going on, right? So he's kind of not in this super, you know, recreation of scene. He's just kind of setting you up for it. And then he's really funny and witty. So yeah, which is kind of your style.
Yeah, yeah, commentary.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I always
He's a great commentator.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. As most gay men usually are. They're pretty good about...
Exactly.
You know, like commenting.
And is it because of the alienation and they're always like...
Yeah, they're able to see you a little bit.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, absolutely, man. That they all were, but of course they're not. God damn Proust.
Well, yeah, that's true. Oh, well, yeah, it's
that's
like...
That's so interesting that Proust, just like... Hamlet's ghost, Hamlet's father, just keeps reappearing in our podcast. My gosh, tremendous! Tremendous. What are the analogs of painters, musicians?
There was a while when we would have conversations, you'd bring up painters a lot, but I think you were reading a lot of those, like you were looking through a lot of painting books and stuff, and. I don't know.
I actually really like looking at paintings. I really like that. It's so much more
relaxing.
But you've
never been in a museum.
I know, but I just need the iconography.
Yeah.
If that's the right way to pronounce it. I just like the ideas coming out, and I picked up this little book on Van Gogh, man. I read it for about an hour. Just looking at the pictures, so relaxing.
But there's got to be something there about why you've never been in a museum. You like art, but you've never gone into a museum. It's kind of fascinating.
I don't like standing around. I don't like standing around.
Well, they have little benches you can sit on and look at the art if you want.
Right, it's true. That's funny you would remember that. Yeah, I've almost walked into the Louvre, the Rich Museum. Several museums, but I like go up there and there are all these people waiting. I'm going, God, I could have a beer right now. Actually, I'm an alcoholic and they don't serve beer in museums.
Yes, they do.
they do now.
They do. Well, at least the one in Chicago and the one in Minneapolis.
Really? The art museum does?
Yeah. Well, they got like a little, a little snack shop or whatever.
And my favorite painting is in the art museum of Chicago.
Which one?
Le Grand Jatt by... Seurat. God, what a great painting. Oh my gosh.
The Chicago Art Museum is just, it's a little overwhelming for me.
But they do have a bar there.
Yeah, it's like a little snack bar, yeah. And they serve beer and wine, yeah.
That's tremendous. Yeah, well, that's the only reason.
Or you could just go in smashed, you know, like a good like a good artist, and
like Hemingway.
Yeah. Hemingway would have had a brunch with champagne before he went, and then they would spend.
I know. Yeah. Thank you, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, and we're going to go back through Husserl and Proust. I was actually stopped. I was driving back down Yellowstone, and at the corner there, General Reeder, in Pocatello, Idaho, you've got Highway 30 coming from the on Garrett Way meeting Highway 91, Yellowstone Avenue meeting, and right there, they've decided to plant some poor little dwarf pine tree. And it's pretty grim there. But in the morning, I was stopped there, and the wind was blowing. It was kind of gray, and I was noticing how here's this just like simple, the simplest gray-green, dark shadowed gray-green, and the wind was moving it. And I was looking, and I was going, oh, yeah, I see that. Cézanne is just painting his ideas of what he's perceiving. You know, he's just kind of going, and on one side of it, it's a little darker gray-green. And that's all he's doing. He's not painting what's there at all. He's just painting what he's, the idea of the wind, the angle of the light.
Yeah.
And the other side, and that's the other thing about this shrub is that the other side, you know, the lee side of where the sun was a little different shadow, a little different light, right? But I just had this great perception of what they were talking about in the later 19th century, is which influenced Einstein.
Yeah.
All you can
relativity.
Do.
Yeah.
All you can do is recreate what your perception is of a something that's going on.
Relatively says that.
And maybe rhythmically, right? But I mean, and Shakespeare's reading all this stuff, man. He's, and it.
Well, relativity suggests that every perception is simultaneously different, right? I mean, and right,
this guy's brilliant, man. I'm telling you, man, Jonah, you get on it periodically, man. Simultaneously different, and it has to be.
Yeah, it has to be. Yeah.
It has to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah.
That's tremendous, yeah.
There's no other way it could be.
Right. Well, exactly. Exactly.
Even though technically I also am sort of obsessed with similarities, so I don't know.
Well, you see, I mean, just like it's funny, you go back to the pendulum. There are anomalies in that pendulum, but the basic structure is always going to be like that, right? But yeah, it has to be simultaneously different at all times, the whole universe, at all times, man. That's the most profound thing I have read or heard in probably 10 years.
It doesn't make me feel good because I just stumbled
in. Because you have no respect for my infinite knowledge. That's the reason.
It will said it's brilliant. It must be. It must be.
Yes. wide reading, profound insight. All these things I bring to bear at these podcasts.
Well, as I've stated earlier in the article I wrote about you, I second guessed some of your pronouncements on people when you, like, every time somebody would come in, you'd be like, oh, this person's so good at this, you know, like, this is the best, they're the greatest at what they do, like, you just said it to everybody.
It's the simultaneity of difference.
Yeah, well, there you go. There you go. Yeah, I mean, maybe they are.
I'm proof of it.
Yeah.
Hmm. Oh my gosh. Well, I gotta say, man, that dinner I had up on top of Mink Creek Saturday, that was one of the greatest dinners ever. because the Thunderbolt Kid of Los Baños, California, was telling stories of growing up in California.
The Thunderbolt Kid. Why was he called the Thunderbolt
Well,
Kid?
There are these grassy hills outside of Los Baños where the fathers would travel between, you know, presidios. And they would get grassy, and so they would take this pickup up there, and they would put a sled behind it, and they would drive over these hills, and somebody would be on these sleds. They get to be going like 40 miles an hour. And pretty soon the pickup would like not be able to go into a gully, so the sled would like go flying. And on top of that, Tom had these really nice Vortex binoculars to look at Indian Peak and Scout Mountain, that you hit a button and it immediately focuses for you. And on top of that, I drank like a six-pack of IPAs.
It's good, yeah. It's
and
a good
then party. We had a great dinner. But yeah, that was one of the greatest dinners ever because it had everything. It just had, you know, conversation, view. The wind would, somehow, the junipers around his house survived the Charlotte fire. So the wind would just come up there and it would just like, whew, you know, just move through there. Oh God, it was a great night. So yeah, that was the best night ever. And I swear, a few of the people that came in here were justifiably the best at something. From my relative point of view.
Well, yeah, from the positivist, well, I don't know.
God, you look like Nietzsche now in profile. I swear to God. I got to get a photograph of you.
Because of the mustache.
The hair swap back. No, you do look like him, man.
Yeah.
That's great.
So
we haven't talked about Nietzsche lately.
Well, that means my insanity is dawning. It's the dawn. The dawn of my brilliance will begin shortly, and the setting of my insanity is 15 years around the corner.
But he didn't get medication or understanding, and he was in Nazi Germany, too.
That's true.
So he had a lot of running against him. No, that's spectacular, man. I'm starting to think that Nietzsche... Nietzsche was... you're Swiss... So yeah, I mean, there had to be some kind of Scandinavian going across there, man. That's but no, I'm gonna get a shot of you, man. Don't get your hair cut.
All right.
I'm serious. It's just fantastic. Yeah.
Well, you know why Nietzsche had a long mustache, don't you?
No.
It's because he could could hang out in cafes and look like a German cavalry officer.
Which he was.
Well.
He washed out, but he was briefly.
He was in the military for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, he just learned, you know, put on a little affectation and nobody will bother you.
Isn't that
Which a lot of people never learn, which seems so obvious to me. You know, I mean, almost everybody does learn it. You know, usually, I mean, most of your middle class people learn, okay, if I put on an affectation, I'm just going to glide through life in that simple sense.
Yeah, give people what they expect.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's what's so wonderful about in here, man. I'm astounded what I get away with in here. So I'm just astounded, man.
Well, I've never seen you be in here in your pajamas or anything. I've never seen you...
No, and we're hoping this doesn't happen. Speaking, yeah. I do have that poncho that I got on that great day, though.
Mm.
And... yeah, when I start showing up in my poncho, Jonah, you will be able to say, "Well, no more podcasts, man."
Just poncho and nothing else underneath. Straight poncho.
But I think the black cotton boxer shorts. I will make sure I wear those. But even then, I have to tell you though, the other night I was settled in for the night for Sunday. And I did put on the poncho and pull on the black tight boxer, and I went out and See, I have to move the car, gentle reader, in front of my store, or they'll tow my car away on Main Street. So I went out in my poncho, fired up the car, drove it into the corner parking lot, and walked back. And actually, I felt quite stuffy. Like,
yeah, you should have.
You know? You should've. Hey, Indians have been around here for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
This, you know, yeah. This is just a deja vu of a kind, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, being single, I get away with a lot of stuff.
Well, hell, I think that might help you with when the Mexican chick comes up. That's that's how you should first greet her.
Thank
just
you.
Just in a poncho. And
oh, God, I know. No, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you can go to the bar and she'll be like, man, this guy's eccentric and interesting.
I know. And because
women think about clothes.
Apparently. Why? Yeah, the running shoes, the running shoes and the poncho. That was such a great day, man. God, and do you realize that was the last powwow? It was 2 years ago, wasn't it?
I think maybe, yeah.
It was only 2 years ago. Yeah. And the next, that last year was COVID, man. And I called you up and said, hey, we got to go out there, man. And hey, Jonah's saying, no, there ain't no powwow. Oh, my God. God, that was a great trip. And we went over to the... next time you come to Pocatello, y'all, you got to go to the powwow, and then you go over, and you watch the racehorses, and then you're like maybe a half a mile from where you can hear the singers, and they do sound like coyotes faintly in the distance, and that old Episcopal church there, and all the graves, and there ain't no grass there, baby, it's all stone and plastic flowers. Just rocks, piles of rocks, right?
Yeah, I mean it's a good graveyard.
Good graveyard.
In my ranking of graveyards, it's probably number 5.
Oh yeah.
Well, my number 1 has to be the Magnolia in Charleston,
right.
South Carolina.
Right.
That's a beautiful graveyard. Right. I spent so much time in that graveyard.
Really?
Yeah. Oh God, that's a beautiful graveyard.
Charleston, SC.
Yeah.
Gosh, I've got to get on the Amtrak. Go see that graveyard. I got to see what formed you as an intellectual.
Well, the railroad track is very close, actually.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know. Yeah.
I don't know if the Amtrak would go all the way.
Well, the Amtrak will go to that stem, though. Right, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
I just got to go to Philly and head south.
Have you ever gotten on the open ocean before on a boat? Like, have you made a continental journey on a boat?
Trump, you have over me.
No, but I didn't do it on a boat. I just flew.
Right.
I don't think.
But
that
you've
counts.
Been across the bay, one of those bays, even, haven't you?
On a boat? Yeah, maybe. I don't.
On a ferry. See, I wouldn't even get on a ferry across Alaska, man.
You wouldn't get on a ferry?
No, nothing crossing open water in Alaska. I'm not really gonna.
So maybe the problem that you couldn't get out of that One Time a Fool book was. You were actually intimidated by the idea of being on the open ocean in a...
I think you're right. No, I really believe that, man. I think you're absolutely right. You know, my... stop me if I've told you this before, but, you know, my beautiful second wife went into this deep meditation, and she saw me reclining, lounging with my long body on the deck of this ship, which was basically had a mark, what's the word, if you get a letter from the king saying you can just kill all Spanish and take all their money, Spanish,
okay,
and other people, right? Right. A mark, a letter of mark. Basically, Cook, Drake, they all had letters of mark, so they could pillage a Spanish ship.
Right.
So anyway, whether I was whatever, but she said she saw me laying on the deck of this nice ship, and I was the king, the captain of it, and it was my ship, and I was dying, and she was my slave girl, and I treated her horribly. And she realized, looking at me, that she had been brought in this world here, to somehow get over her hatred for me. By marrying me. Women's logic is sometimes beyond optimistic, man. But yeah, no, I believe that totally. I just do not
You can't let yourself be a captain of a ship because
I don't get out in the open ocean, man. I've had a lot of opportunities, and I just won't do it. I just say, you know, I think I'll just stay on shore and have a beer and have dinner, and you guys go have a good time. I've swum in the ocean, you know, as long as I'm within, like 50 yards ashore, then I'm fine. But
wait, did that vision actually affect you that much?
I believe her. I believe she's right.
How could she have been a slave girl? I mean, what you just mean, like the metaphorical idea of her being.
Well, no, she's Jewish, so I mean, Jewish, Arabian, Turkish. I mean, Scandinavians always had these slave girls, man. They were going over, they'd pick them up, and, you know, 10 pieces of gold for a really pretty woman, you know. And they're usually smarter than you are, too, you know. But yeah, my family has a history of slaves. My mother is blonde, blue-green eyed, really blonde. And my younger brother is as black as the Ace of Spades. I mean, he's got the big brown eyes, he's got the swarthy skin. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of black blood, man. So I totally believe it. And then I ran into an old Danish guy who said, or Swedish guy, and I said, God, you look just like my relatives. And you got those black eyes, and you got that kind of, you know, swarthy, olive-colored skin. And he said, oh, yeah, without some nice Turkish, Syrian, Jewish slave girls from the Black Sea, I mean, life was far too cold and long in Scandinavia. I mean, you'll see towns there that are just black-eyed people are everywhere, you know. That's just the way it was.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I've also heard that blue eyes are a recessive gene. And that,
right,
in like 100 years or something, right, they'll be out of the gene pool or something to that effect.
Well, maybe, I don't know. They're always going to be. But see, that's the point, is that it is recessive, but it will be recessive in a generation or two. But it'll always come back, you know. You'll always get. There are always blue-eyed girls and blue-eyed boys in families where the parents are dark, you know. It just shows up, man. It's infinite. Like you were saying, man, infinite difference of in simultaneity, man.
Yeah.
That's just what, gosh. But no, that's really true. My grandmother was big black eyes, black hair, olive skin, and the other thing is how hairy I am. I mean, all these, you see pictures of all these Turks and Syrians. They're all these hairy fucking people, man. They're just,
yeah,
you know, they're just, you know, and in the as you all know, gentle reader, the bell curves of the that was so prevalent in the 19th century. Why the blue-eyed Scandinavian German is so superior, right? Is that they don't have any black blood in them. They don't have hairy bodies, and they don't have sloping heads, and they don't have voluptuous lips, you know, and all this stuff.
That's such a weird logic. It's like, oh, yeah, because this is this way, that's better. Yeah. Like, what? What? What logic is that? Like,
yeah, and they were running universities, too. I mean, they were doctors.
Yeah.
They were, oh, I know, God. So horrible, man. It's so horrible. And here we have it today, man. I don't know where these people come from, man.
My big thing is I really believe it's far less prevalent than anybody's talking about it. I mean, I don't know.
So you think it's just fear?
Yeah,
just sociological, economic fear.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Right. I don't know, man. There's something that's so irrational about it. I just can't deal with it. And I think we talked about it in the last podcast is that.
But irrationality doesn't scare me. Like, because irrationality can be overcome in some sense. I mean.
It can't be.
Yes, it can.
No, it cannot be. Irrationality is irrational.
No. Irrationality is rational. Irrationality can be overcome.
You're mixing oil and water.
No. There's nothing.
Apples and oranges?
There's nothing that says that irrationality can't be changed. There's nothing that says that. You know what's much harder to change? is rationality that has found devices to prove
itself. A tremendous riposte that I have to agree with. I have to agree with totally, man. Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Yeah. No, okay, I accept that about rationality. But no, I just can't figure out... What was I thinking? Oh, the fact of the other, and we talked about with Kafka. Okay, that's the other book we talked about.
Yeah,
is Kafka.
That's another one.
All right, it's see, like I'm four, always on it. So yeah, we talked about the other, and how the whole thing about Eastern Idaho is the reason all these irrational, xenophobes and blackophobes and et cetera, the reason they're all so easy to get along with is that their phobia is, the other is abstract. It's in Chicago, it's in Portland, da-da-da, but it's not here.
Yeah.
But if in Germany in the 1930s you have the other right next to you, now you got a reason for fear and paranoia and violence, right?
I guess, but I mean, like, you have to build a sense of paranoia to...
Well, they do. They do it. They do it every day, man. They do it every day.
Yeah, right? But it's... I don't know. I just feel like it's harder to be effective, to be ethical.
Efficacious.
Efficacious.
I'm glad I finally got to help you with the word.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in Salmon, Idaho, getting ready to get on the river, and in this, restaurant, brewery. And there's a guy sitting there. He's a young guy, and he's... And there's an older couple there, and I could tell who is buying. The older couple is buying because he's just entertaining them with his knowledge. And he's talking about Mexicans, and he's saying, "They're waiting at the border, man. They're coming. They're coming." And I'm thinking, oh, I can just see this flood of Mexicans going up Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Birch Creek.
Just consuming 300 things
miles.
Like locusts.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But that's the last thing. They're coming. They're coming. And then I was overhearing. You know me, I kind of do eavesdrop. And the bill.
That's a good writer.
And the bill came. And the bill came. And I knew this guy was not going to pick up the check. Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, thanks, man. You know, I've given you the gospel, and the least you can do is buy my dinner, right? But no, I heard that, man. And the rhetorical power of, they're coming, man. I've seen them. They're coming. And it's like, okay, what are these Mexicans going to do? I mean, take your farm, take your daughters, kill your sons.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. I guess it's very biblical in that sense. It's like, yeah, it's like I can see the future.
The Moabites are coming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah. But we deserve the promised land, and we've got to fight for it.
Yeah, there you go. There it is. There it is, yeah. And I think you've got the whole essence of it. Yeah, there's definitely... this strong, oh my gosh, never forgotten that. But yeah, that's the idea of the other. When the other is like right there, you get paranoid and you get dangerous. And as long as it's in Chicago, New York, L.A., then they can be kind of simple and...
Well, that's why... I think you're right, but just to expand on that in a sense, people forget how hugely rural the United States still is,
right?
In a lot of ways. I mean, there's a lot of people who just don't understand what some of these talking points coming out of New York and LA are even talking about. I mean, Idaho in and of itself is the size of France. Just one state.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole country. Mm. And that's one of my friends. He started going on this whole paranoid tirade about how each individual state is going to start fighting against other states, and they're going to become their own thing. Like, each state is going to be their own little nation eventually.
With warlords.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, it's right out of fantasy fiction, And they all got these monsters.
Would be really fun, though,
what?
Is to describe the warlord of each state. Like, you got to write out a description of the warlord of each thing.
Oh my god, that's great, man. That's great.
That would be really fun.
Oh god, that's tremendous. Gentle reader, you thought by listening to this you were wasting your time. If you will steal this idea, this is the greatest ever. Oh my gosh. So, yeah. Absolutely, man.
The warlord of Idaho. Does he have, like, an elk tooth? an elk tooth, what? Like a little bit of a poncho or a gun.
He's definitely got the the elk tooth, you know, the spectacular muscles and the flaring golden hair and the flashing eyes and the and the gaiters, right, for walking through the snow. And then we'll match him with the Black Lord of East LA, who is right, and they meet somewhere in the desert out of San Bernardino in Nevada. Who would Nevada be?
Oh, I don't know.
Nevada would be a mafiosa or something with bling. Yeah. He's got bling, and he works out in the gym all day, and he looks Italian, right? He's from LA.
And he's got an army of female stripper bodyguards, like Omar Gaddafi. Oh, yeah, like.
Oh my god, man.
That wear high heels that have little knives.
Yeah. Oh my god. Oh, we're letting this brilliant. This is worth millions of dollars what we're letting out here.
Which warlords of which state would be female? Which state has a feminine warlord?
Oh my god, if we get some lesbian I think we ought to have a lesbian warlordess.
Oh, of course.
From New York City or gosh, I don't know.
I feel like you kind of want to roll against the tide and go like Louisiana or something, like something.
Oh, where, exactly.
Where?
Oh, well, this would be
like
an
alligator woman.
This would be a transvestite black Creole alligator woman from Louisiana. Of course, that would really piss off the Cajuns.
She's a warlord. She kills anybody who stands in her way. Exactly. I mean, it doesn't.
It's not about
optics anymore. She's just winning.
She has cowed the Cajuns. The Cajuns are out there just still getting crawfish and hanging out in the jungle. Oh my gosh. This could be the greatest book ever.
It's too complex.
There are just too many chapters.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. The plot is like five different. This is not a quartet, it's like a quintet, man.
And then you got
5,000 pages.
Then you got Louisa May Alcott being the warlord of Nebraska or something. Just like
Vermont.
Yeah.
Yes, we got the warlord of Vermont. Oh my god, we could make a lot of enemies with this book, actually.
But that's what would make it fun, right?
Yeah. Or Massachusetts, right? Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, we got to work the amphibious jeep in there somewhere. The warlord from Seattle has got these amphibious jeeps, not realizing they're of no good in conquering Montana or Nevada.
Yeah.
Or the inland states.
He's only interested in Canada for some reason. He's just fixated on like conquering Canada. He doesn't even care about the other states. He's got his own agenda.
Oh god, I know where he goes up to Columbia. Oh my god, what a great. Jeez, we're gonna need some help getting this done, man.
We need a lot of help. A lot. Not least of which.
Okay. We're going to end this podcast with, what is the title of this great epic?
Of the Wasteland Warlords?
Wasteland Warlords.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you could almost set them in a smaller space.
Oh, God.
And just call each of them by their names of the states.
Oh, my God. The Nevada Warlord, though, with the strippers, with the... real stiletto heels. Kung Fu stiletto heels. How's that?
Yeah.
For a chapter.
Yeah.
Kung Fu stiletto heels. And of course, all his opponents just melt in front of him with terror.
For some reason, the guy from Mississippi, I feel like, has a lot of Molotov cocktails or something. It's all about fire with the Mississippi guy. I don't know why.
Interesting.
But, this.
Interesting. That's right. We ought to get a blues. We ought to get a blues warlord in there.
Yeah, some of them. Some of them have to be benevolent. Yeah. Some of them need to be. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Right, and the music, man.
Because it's like gods, you know. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's just recreating the gods for a modern audience by using...
Right.
But creating 50 gods is a task for a god. I mean, it's
I know,
not a
and
task
in
for
Connecticut a god. Would be insurance salesman. Warlords.
he sells insurance to the
They're trying
gods.
To sell you insurance on the side.
No, he's just immortal.
If you
like he figured out how to live forever, and he sells that idea.
If you capitulate, I got a great deal on some insurance, man. Oh, God, we're going to play with all... See, that's the problem. We play with all these cliches, man. You just get people pissed off at you, man.
Well.
And we'll have our own map. We ought to start with a map, anyway. Because that'd be easy to do, because you and I will never do this.
No. Not
Damn.
A million years. No, it's just fun to talk about that song.
It's fantastic.
Like, yeah, it's
well, fun. Let's do the map anyway. I will get somebody to do the characters. That's all these kids want to do is like
come up
comic
with,
books.
Yeah, yeah.
No more Hemingway. No more Cormac McCarthy. None of this, man. It's all comic books.
It's true.
Oh my gosh, we'd have East Citadel. Oh, it's so great. So great, man.
It would be an epic. It would be a true, true epic.
Right, well, let's just start with a map. Next time you come by, I'll get a big old sheet.
If only I could draw. I can't draw for shit.
No, we just gotta... We'll find somebody. God, I've got all these kids that all they do is draw manga. Oh my God. We could have... A manga girl is one warlord. A 13-year-old nymphet.
So
I never thought I would sell pornography in here. I'm selling like these people are ordering manga, and I'm looking. I'm going, okay, right. And then I do see, you know, parental guidance. Jesus Christ, man.
Well, is it actual pornography? Are they having sex in it, or is it just like
they're anatomically correct, you know, they've got to look like they're 12 years older. It's not worth it, man. I'm telling you that.
Yeah.
I mean, I stand to be corrected, but manga is just like, it's just pornography, man.
Yeah. I mean,
and
that's
it's for 12-year-old girls, it's for 15, 16-year-old kids, or developmentally retarded, you know, 30 and 40-year-old people, right?
Yeah.
And it's a huge business, man. Oh my God, man. Yes, gentle reader.
It's surprising. I mean, when I went out on Saturday, like I was just I saw this guy who had a, you know, Japanese t-shirt with anime on it. But it was like one of these really sort of sophisticated darker animes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very popular. It's
Oh, yeah, there's got to be a spectrum, yeah, yeah, yeah. These girls grow up, but man, yeah, it's culture.
Culture. I like it.
So, yeah.
That should be a rap breakdown, I think, at the end.
So, yeah.
We're talking about culture.
Well, I mean, you know, I think you should turn this off. But
it's your job now. You started.
Gentle reader, we're gonna get in some really heavy stuff next week. Until next time, from Pocatello, Idaho, on Main Street.
This has been
Western Thought.
Oh, there we go.